This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first edition of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass was published in 1855 in an edition of 795 copies. Whitman retitled it Song of Myself in 1881. My guest Robert Haas describes it as perhaps the most unprecedented poem in the English language. Whitman revised the poem through his life. Haas has edited and written the introduction to the new book Song of Myself and Other Poems by Walt Whitman. Haas describes Song of Myself as a poem about democracy and imagination and what to make of life and death. Haas was poet laureate from 1995 to 97 and is a two-time winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. In addition to the Whitman book, Haas just published a new collection of his own poems called The Apple Trees at Olema. His new book, Song of Myself, reprints the poem as it appeared in 1885 and as it appeared in the final edition from 1891 to 92.
The first few lines begin, famously, "I celebrate myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass." And in the last edition, he writes, "I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass." So that he just made this really small change. He added the phrase, "and sing myself." In the first edition, it had no name. And then in the second, he called it Walt Whitman. And then I think he called it Walt Whitman, an American, for a while. And it really wasn't until the end of his life that he called it by the name that all school children know it by, Song of Myself. And I think it was at that point also that he added the phrase, "and sing myself."
Why is Song of Myself so important in the history of American poetry?
Well, a bunch of reasons. But the first one is it was the first experiment in extended free verse. Nobody had done that before. The thing that he took from English poetry, I think, was what the romantic poets like Wordsworth saying they wanted to write poems in the language men actually spoke, to get away from what felt like artificial in the diction of 18th century poetry. Whitman, who, you know, had an 11th, dropped out of school in the 7th grade and got his education as an editor and a typesetter, grew up with the language of newspapers, and he wanted a new kind of verse for a new country, and he imagined that that verse would be the rhythms of actual speech. So that's one very important thing, that first experiment. And the second reason it's important is because it's written at a particular moment before the Civil War, after the Revolution, of enormous optimism and hopefulness about the country. Some people have said Walt Whitman invented the imagery of the New Deal in 1855 by talking about this cascade of democratic images of all kinds of people.
Walt Whitman is always considered, like, you know, the quintessential American poet. And he writes about the American city, and he writes about American diversity. I mean, Whitman was into praising diversity before our time.
Like, yes.
Diversity is so in now, but Whitman literally used the word diversity.
Almost invented it.
Yeah, and I want you to read an example that I think will give a sense of his love of the city, his sense of diversity, and also his you know, free verse, his lack of rhyme. Mm-hmm. And another thing it gives a sense of is how he'd often just do lists of things, just like tumbling lists of similar things that he wanted to talk about. So Would you read this section for us that begins, "The blab of the pave"?
Sure. Isn't that wonderful?
Pave is in pavement and blab is in blabber.
That was the fun of walking across the campus and think, what would the dictionary say about blab in 1850? Anyway, the blab of the pave, the tires of carts and slough of boot soles and talk of the promenaders, the heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating thumb, the clank of the shod horses on the granite floor, the carnival of sleighs, the clinking and shouted jokes and pelts of snowballs, the hurrahs for popular favorites, the fury of roused mobs, the flap of the curtained litter, the sick man inside borne to the hospital, the meeting of enemies, the sudden oaths, the blows and falls, the excited crowd, the policeman with his star quickly working his passage to the center of the crowd, the impassive stones that receive and return so many echoes, the souls moving along, are they invisible while the least atom of the stone is visible? What groans of overfed or half-starved who fall on the flag sunstruck or in fits? What exclamations of women taken suddenly who hurry home and give birth to babes? What living and buried speech is always vibrating here? What howls restrained by decorum? Arrests of criminals, slights, adulterous offers made, acceptances, rejections with convex lips. I mind them or the resonance of them. I come again and again.
There's several phrases that are changed in the final version, but most dramatically, the last phrase of that section you just read. So would you read the last phrase of the original and the last phrase of the final edition?
Yes, the last phrase of the original is, I come again and again. And the last phrase of the final is, I come and I depart.
What does that difference mean to you?
My guess is that he's an older man when he's writing the last version of the poem, coming and going. And so the first version says, I come again and again. I'm here. I'm always here. There's another line of the poem that says, surge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world, that the continuous presence of the sexual energy of living. And in the last version, I come and I depart. It means everything's coming and going. I come and it's more Buddhist.
It's also, I think he knows he's nearing mortality. He's not going to be coming again and again.
Yeah, he was writing one of the last sections of the final version of the poem. There's a section called Sands at 70, and then another called Last Annex. So he was getting near the end and thinking about it.
Now, you mentioned in your introduction that Emerson, who was a champion of Whitman's early on, got kind of tired of that list-making, that cataloging that we hear in the excerpt that you just read. Why did he get tired of that? How do you feel about that constant list-making?
Well, I think everybody gets tired of it. The thing about Whitman is, I think what Emerson said, I thought he was going to write the great poems of America, and he wrote the catalog. at that time when they arrived as regularly as they do now. He overuses the technique. I mean, he celebrates abundance. He's an incredibly abundant writer. I think when I began reading him without a sense of how terrific the best of the poems were, I thought he was kind of a gas bag, partly because of this endless list thing. When you look at it in the poems, this like Song of Myself, when he's at the top of his form, every single image is very wonderful, vivid and amazing and accurate with the newspaper reporter's accuracy that he had. They flash before the eye like those illustrations in 19th century books, one figure after another, the policeman with his star quickly works and so on, all of that, all ways of getting at the city. But at certain points, he's listing anything he can think to list, and he loses me, but not in this poem. This poem is a miracle in the way that it keeps keeps coming back to this sense of the enormous variety and abundance and diversity and vitality of life.
One of the things about Whitman is that he's in his own way, I think it's fair to say, like a mystic, where everything is everything is embodied in everyone. Everyone embodies everything. But he's also like an egotist. So, like, I always find when I read Whitman, I never know, like, which part is like a huge ego and which part is this like great mystical exuberance. What do you think? Do you feel that way too?
Yes, I do. But I think that in Song of Myself, I think it's pure exuberance. And it is a mystical. Someone said it's the only comic mystical poem because the mystical insight at the core of the poem is, if you say it, it sounds banal. You know, it's here I am. It's, and here we all are. And we all can feel our way into each other, and everybody is everybody else. And one response one might have to that is to say, no, you're not me. At some point in this period, he said about himself when he was writing these poems, I was simmering, and Emerson brought me to a boil. He was reading Emerson's essays, and he had some sense, you know, young guy from a troubled family who grew up and making it in the streets of Brooklyn, which is a huge exploding suburb, and of Manhattan, that he had this sense that all life is life right now, that everything is alive, and that it's to be celebrated, and the enormity of it is to be celebrated, and the surprise of it is to be celebrated. The shocking thing he says about that at the beginning of the poem is, I'm going to tell you in this poem that death is different from what anybody supposed, and luckier, which is the kind of joke at the core of the poem, that all life is eternal in the imagination if you act like it is.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you now to read something that I think really reflects that mystical streak in Whitman. And this is the section of Song of Myself that starts with, and there is no object so soft.
There is no object so soft, but it makes a hub for the wheeled universe. And any man or woman shall stand cool and supercilious before a million universes. And I call to mankind, be not curious about God, for I who am curious about each am not curious about God. No array of terms can say how much I am at peace about God and about death. I hear and behold God in every object, yet I understand God not in the least, nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24 and each moment then. In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name, and I leave them where they are, for I know that others will punctually come forever and ever. And as to you, death, and you, bitter hug of mortality, it is idle to try to alarm me.
I just really love that section of Song of Myself. It really speaks to that sense of everything being God. How would you define what you know of Whitman's version of spirituality?
Well, you got it exactly right. His mother was Quaker. His father was Dutch background from Long Island, and people have described him as a kind of radical working man rationalist, follower of Tom Paine. And Whitman's language is suffused with the language of Quaker spirituality, which is some idea of the family of man. But his religion at this point is that he sees God in everything.
There's a line I want to quote that I think gives the sense of my confusion between his egotism and his mysticism. Uh-huh. And also, it has a great, really earthy phrase in it. He says, divine I am inside and out, and I make holy whatever I touch or am touched from. The scent of these armpits is aroma finer than prayer. But, you know, I make holy whatever I touch. I mean, does he see himself as particularly holy, or is he speaking for everybody, that everybody is
holy? He's speaking for everybody, but he gets the outrage and the comedy of it. He says, "I know no sweeter fat than sticks to my own bones," he says in another line. But he keeps meaning that it's so of everybody. And in fact, there's nothing very personal in this poem in that way. It's not the personal narcissism of the person who says, you know, and another thing about me, this is a poem about everybody.
How hard was it for Walt Whitman to get these kind of radical for their time poems published?
Well, he had no trouble getting them published because he put up the money and did part of the hand printing himself. The poems were published in the same year as the Song of Hiawatha was published by Longfellow, by a respectable Boston publisher, and it sold hugely. And the first version of Leaves of Grass, according to his brother, I think he printed 500 copies, and it managed to distribute five or six of them. Getting it printed wasn't the problem. Getting himself read and believed in took some time. But by the end of his life, you know, he was a figure of some... He was certainly a cult figure, and he was a figure of some eminence. And there were writers from all over the world would come to visit him in Camden, New Jersey, in his last house there to meet the phenomenon of Walt Whitman. And I think that he made some money by having a brand of cigars named after him, so that his white bearded face smiling in his slouch hat appears on a box of cigars that I've seen at the Smithsonian, I think.
You have a lexicon in the middle of the book with words from Whitman's time that we wouldn't understand, but our knowledge of these words will help us appreciate what he was saying. And it's good you have it there. I mean, like, there's one phrase in particular where I found it really helpful. He says, "Through me the afflatus surging and surging." And afflatus, it sounds like flatulence. I don't know whether you say flatus or afflatus, but it sounds like there's flatulence surging through him. But afflatus or afflatus actually means the miraculous communication of supernatural knowledge, which kind of changes the whole feel of what he's saying there.
Yeah, it's a word from 19th century theology. It was fun to look and say, blab of the pave. Does anybody else use the word pave as a noun? No. Is the answer. We looked in every possible source. Another place he says, the kelson of creation is love. I looked up kelson. Whitman grew up on Long Island and then in Brooklyn, where there's a shipyard, so he loved watching guys build boats. And the kelson is the piece of wood that connects the rudder to the frame of the boat. So it was enormous fun doing the lexicon, because it got us a chance to look at exactly the way he used these words. And over again, they turned out to be terrifically precise. When the young Henry James reviewed the first or an early version of Song of Mice, Whitman would throw in foreign words. And James, with a little bit of fastidious snobbery, said, "One must regret Mr. Whitman's too extensive acquaintance with the foreign languages," as a way of putting him down for the pretension. And one example was, he talks about the rushing by in the street, the flaps of the ambulanza. But when we looked it up, it turned out that the first army to develop a service to get wounded soldiers very quickly from the battle to hospital tents was the Italian army, or the Piedmontese army, during the Crimean War. And the term for these very fast-moving wagons taking people to the hospital was ambulanza, and it was the newest, most cool word. So... over and over, when I looked up words in the dictionary to see Whitman was in 1855. There was always some surprising, interesting accuracy or some area like the word afflatus or flatus, I don't know. Since nobody ever says it, how would we know how to pronounce it?
Here's something that really baffles me about Whitman, given his mystical streak. He commissioned a granite mausoleum. And I guess, why would you want that kind of, like, physical monument to your bones if you really believed in the divinity of everything and in the, you know, eternal presence of everything?
Yeah. I mean, it turns out he was a Victorian. You know, it was the century of the beautiful cemetery when everybody had a terrific appetite for these marble mausoleums, and turned out he's just like everybody else.
Have you ever visited the mausoleum?
It's true. No, I haven't, and I think for me, that the famous end of Song of Myself is, I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged, missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you. I think that's his burial place for me. I don't really need to go to the mausoleum. I take him at his word. He's under our boot soles.
Under our boot soles and on our bookshelves.
Yeah.
Just one more thing. I want you to talk a little bit about the impact that his free verse had on American poetry and how radical it was at the time. As you point out in the book, we take it for granted now.
Yeah, well, the impact was slow. I think people associated the free verse with the lists, with the catalogs, and with the parts of Whitman's, I Hear America Singing that sound like 19th century political oratory. So people didn't quite know how to deal with his free verse, and basically didn't for 50 years. Then in 1911, 1912, the young modernist poets started to experiment with free verse, which they thought of not as an American thing coming out of Whitman, but as an avant-garde technique coming out of France. And Ezra Pound who grew up in the not far from Whitman's country in Philadelphia suburb, wrote a poem called A Pact. It begins, "I make a pact with you, Walt Whitman. You roughed it out, and now we're going to refine it," is basically what the poem says. So, and when people worked in free verse in the early 20th century, except for Carl Sandburg and a little bit Langston Hughes, they were working out of European models, not out of Whitman as a model. And it really, really wasn't until Allen Ginsberg wrote Howl that somebody took what Whitman had done and tried to do something more with it.
Robert Hass, thank you so much for talking with us about Whitman and for reading some of his work. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Robert Hass edited and wrote the introduction to the new book, Song of Myself and Other Poems by Walt Whitman. You can read the introduction on our website, freshair.npr.org. Hass also has a new collection of his own poems called The Apple Trees at Olema. We'll close with an excerpt of pianist and composer Fred Hirsch's album, Leaves of Grass, featuring Kurt Elling singing Song of Myself.
I celebrate myself and sing myself. I celebrate myself and sing myself. And what I assume you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me is good belongs to you.